Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It's Tuesday, October 29th. This is the eve of the 20th anniversary of the devastating floods in Manoa Valley that changed the way that we look at critical services. Today, we look at what we've done since then to make vital government operations less vulnerable to water threats. Rising seas and bigger ships, that's what's being planned for. We hear how harbor users are about to launch a new campaign to raise awareness about resiliency. There is great potential in aquaculture research when it comes to conservation and our economy. We hear about a symbolic release of yellowfish raised on land, and they'll be going back into the ocean. With the general election just a week away, we get the wrap on constitutional amendments that voters will see on the ballot. And the Voice fans have another Hawaii singer to root for. We'll hear her story. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Rain, rain, go away. Come again another day. The recent floodwaters that we've been seeing bring back memories of 2 decades ago. On October 30th, 2004, the Manoa Stream swelled, sending devastating floodwater through the University of Hawaii campus, crippling critical services and highlighting the vulnerabilities of basement offices. We heard from President David Lasner yesterday about lessons learned. Today we hear from the State Comptroller, Keith Regan, about what his office has done to protect those vital government services. Did you know that 20 years ago, all state workers' paychecks were printed in the basement of the Kalani Moku building in the downtown Capital District? That's where we visited Regan last week to talk about what we've done to make ourselves less vulnerable and more resilient.
We actually bought flood barriers very similar to the ones that you saw on television during the most recent hurricanes that impacted Florida in Tampa, where they erected these flood barriers to prevent the water from coming in. And so we've taken some very important steps to ensure that the basement of this facility does not get flooded going forward. And that was actually more than 20 years ago that we bought those flood barriers and deploy them periodically when there's rain events that we see that are anticipated coming into the state that might impact us.
And those are physical barriers, right? Because a lot of folks don't think about the threat from up Mauka. You know, they think of the ocean when they think of water, but we've had some storm drains overflow.
Yeah, that's right. So these are physical barriers that get deployed by our Central Services Division team. They come in. The barriers are stored here within the building, so they're able to retrieve them and install them. Probably takes them about 2, maybe 3 hours to do that. And typically, you know, we have forewarning, right, of an event that's coming, so we can be prepared for those types of things.
Yeah, because we have seen disasters where cars are floating, you know, in the basement garages, and we have a basement garage.
Absolutely. And so we have to be very careful, you know, to make sure that we protect this particular piece of infrastructure that we have here, because there are still employees that operate and work in our basement here within the facility. So even during those times where we deploy those water barriers, we also bring in pumps to ensure that, you know, if there is water that does get into the basement, into that parking facility, we can quickly get rid of that and move that out of here.
We have key systems that are located in our basements. You know, back in the day, I know that I think every single paycheck for all the state employees were processed down there. So where are we at today?
Yeah, fortunately, all the mainframe equipment has been moved off-site, right? So that's all in the cloud now. So we don't have sort of that critical infrastructure that's in the basement anymore. We do have the printing of checks that occurs in the basement, at least for now. Our goal is to move that out at some point in time. We've actually transitioned a lot from the paper checks to now direct deposit. So many of our employees are on direct deposit, so they're not reliant on a paper check. But there are still some. We print probably anywhere to from 60 to 70,000 checks on a monthly basis here from our facility. And so, you know, we still do have a large volume of paper checks that are printed, but our goal is to move that off-site to somewhere that is a little more secure. You know, although we haven't had a rain event or a flood event for more than two decades, getting it out of the basement, I think, is really important for us. And so we're looking for a future site. When you think about some of the work that we've been doing, like at the state capitol, as an example, there's the pool project that you see where the barriers have been erected around the state capitol for a couple of years now. That is another example of how the state is trying to address some of the water intrusion issues that it has, right? And so although we think that those pools are just simply pools with water in them, they're really the roof of the facility because there's offices that are located beneath there. And so that project has been moving along very well. We're on schedule, on budget to get that project completed in totality by about 2026. But all of the waterproofing on the Diamond Head side pool has been completed, and we're in the process of completing the Eva side pool right now as we speak.
For our listeners, I mean, they may not realize that those ponds were full of water mm-hmm. and fish, and they did leak down into our library, the reference bureau downstairs. I mean, I was shocked. I went to go pick up my directory, and I couldn't believe all the water diversions and the buckets in the hallway, and the carpet was sopping. That was kind of shocking for me.
Absolutely, and unacceptable, quite frankly, because we have people that are working in that environment, and we need to make sure that we prevent water from destroying documents and really just making life miserable for all of those employees. So we've done a really good job at getting that issue resolved. On the Senate side, we're now working on the House side, basically, when you think about sort of how it's divided, you know, within the state capitol. The Senate is also known as the Diamond Head Pool, and the House is on the Eva side. But again, you know, we needed to get that job completed so that we could prevent water from intruding into the facility.
And we did have problems with, I think, leaks with the roof, but that I know has been pretty much resolved.
Yeah, other than those leaks that are from the pool, I'm not aware of any additional leaking that is happening that hasn't been already addressed.
And then how do we fortify ourselves in other buildings, you know, whether they be other facilities in the historic capital, you know, downtown district, mm-hmm. you know, like Iolani Palace and the State Archives and the library? I mean, all have precious documents and artifacts.
Yeah, absolutely. And so part of the goal of our department is to really look at deferred maintenance and address the deferred maintenance issues that we have in our facilities. And so when you look at things like Archives had a leaking roof, right, at one point in time, we actually, within the last couple of years, went in there and addressed the leak issue within the Archives facility. And so if you talk to Adam Jansen from the Archives, he'll let you know that, you know, we took very quick action to get some of those issues resolved so that we wouldn't have documents that are irreplaceable be destroyed by water intrusion. But deferred maintenance is a big issue for the state. We have hundreds of millions of dollars in deferred maintenance within our facilities. We're very fortunate that the legislature has given us funding over the years to be able to work through that list. But as you know, every year you tackle projects, there's new projects that get added, right? Because buildings continue to age and continue to have systems that need to be replaced.
Is there anything that keeps you up at night?
Well, you know, making sure that our facilities are safe for our employees, I think, is really important, and for the public that utilize them on a daily basis. And so we, you know, just work very hard to make sure that we keep the facilities in the best shape that we possibly can.
Talk about leaky roofs. I know we've had that problem over at the Hawaii Convention Center, and I know that money was finally appropriated, I think, released. And so I think that project's underway.
Yeah, that's another good example of a roof project, right, that is causing water intrusion into the facility. So I think they have about a little over $60 million that has been allocated by the legislature approved through the governor's, you know, process. And the Hawaii Tourism Authority is working very hard along with the Hawaii Convention Center to make sure that that project moves forward, because, you know, you can't invite these major events to come to Hawaii if, you know, they're having to worry about water closing down, you know, ballrooms and different meeting rooms that are critical, you know, to support those types of events.
Yes, and we did talk to Terry Orton, and she says that did happen. And she just says, no, this has to be a priority because you can't run a business this way.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then I just learned that there are some leaks over at the new building across the way over in Kaneohe at the state hospital.
Yeah, that was one of our projects, Hawaii State Hospital projects. We're working right now with the contractor to address those issues. In fact, we're on our way over there this afternoon to do a site visit along with a couple of legislators to look at what steps we're taking to address those concerns and those issues going forward. We have been working very closely with the Department of Health to, you know, try to mitigate those issues. All of our facilities are important to us. And so as we go through our list of deferred maintenance, you know, we try to prioritize which issues are the most critical that need to be addressed quickly. But, you know, off the top of my head, I can't really think of anything specific other than just making sure that the facilities that are under our control are maintained to the best of our ability.
Anything else that the anniversary of this flood at UH brings top of mind to you?
Yeah, I think it just reinforces the importance of being prepared and being ready to address anything that might be coming down as it relates to storms. Clearly, being in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, we are very vulnerable to hurricanes, to tsunamis, earthquakes, things like that, that, you know, will impact the state and impact our ability to perform and provide services to the public. So we're constantly looking at and practicing and preparing for events that may occur so that if it does happen, we're ready. And I think that's just the most important message to deliver to the public, is that we're constantly looking for ways to be better prepared so that we can make sure that the services that need to be provided to the people, especially during times of crisis, can be delivered.
That was Keith Regan, State Comptroller, who we sat down with last week to reflect on what we've learned when it comes to protecting basement offices and critical services during a flood or heavy rain. Tomorrow marks 20 years since stormwater tore through the UH Manoa campus, knocking out power to several buildings and affecting critical systems and destroying or damaging important library collections.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters should contact their county elections division right away if they have not received their general election ballot. Elections.hawaii.gov.
Through family ties, lots of Moroccans feel a personal connection to Israel, and many believe their government should be pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza.
A lot of Moroccan people live in Israel, so we are like family. But I hope they stop this fire.
Stopping the fire. News of the Middle East from Morocco, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
About 24 companies make up the Hawaii Harbor Users Group. Next year marks 20 years since it was formed. It's been planning for rising seas and bigger vessels, all part of becoming more efficient and resilient, given our dependency on our harbors for our goods and services across our island state. We talked to Melissa Pavlicek yesterday. She chairs the group of users and says it's about to launch a new campaign, the Supply Chain Hawaii Communications Initiative, in November.
Well, the Supply Chain Hawaii Communications Initiative really speaks to the big picture about harbors, how harbors fit into our economy, but specifically on the modernization plan and addressing whether it's sea level rise or the need to be more efficient. Those issues have been worked on by the State Department of Transportation for quite a while, and there's still so many challenges. So we still have buildings and structures in the harbors that are being used as warehouses that were built in the 1920s. So modernization here in the 2020s, you know, we've got a ways to go. But the biggest project, and I think the most exciting one, is the development of the Kapalama Container Terminal. And that's expected to be completed in 2025.
And that is supposed to help our resiliency, because we just really need to rethink of that access point there by the bridge.
Right. So it's building resiliency, building redundancy, and it's also expanding capacity and allowing for some new technology as well as some sustainability initiatives and federal money to be brought into the state of Hawaii so that we have a more efficient port operation. It's really step one to a bigger vision. The total cost of the Kapalama Container Terminal is about $500 million. So it's a big project, and it's very exciting to see that soon to be completed.
We've seen a few headlines. Young Brothers is asking for a big increase, that they want to buy some new barges as part of their plan because the modernization at Kapalama will affect them.
It will affect them, but my understanding is they have not sought a rate increase in at least 5 years. And we need to periodically ensure that we're paying an appropriate rate. Otherwise, we won't be able to keep up as a state with these infrastructure improvements. The second phase of the modernization project is to do a Sand Island container terminal redesign. So once we have Kapalama completed, the focus will then shift to Sand Island, and then following that, an inner island barge terminal. So there's going to be a lot of movement and construction in Honolulu Harbor. But again, not only 85% of our goods come in through harbors, almost all of it, I'd say in excess of 90%, comes through Honolulu Harbor first before getting redistributed to other islands and other areas.
And that's really key. People need to understand that we are the lifeline before the goods go out to, you know, the smaller islands.
Absolutely. And speaking as someone who grew up in Maui, I always have my eyes on what's happening at Kahului, but certainly Big Island, Kauai, all of the 10 ports across the entire state, they are slated for improvements as well. And these are capital improvement projects that will enable the harbors to be stronger, more resilient, and more efficient.
Well, I'll have to correct myself. So not just smaller islands, but there's also the Big Island as well. I did see a story in the newspaper talking about the Hilo expansion.
Yes. So not only is there like redevelopment and entrance improvements plan, but there's a Pier 4 lighting and fire suppression project plan for Hawaii Island in Hilo. And I just can't speak highly enough about our collaboration with the State Department of Transportation, because if we didn't have good communication about what the users are really experiencing in the ports, I don't think we would see such a well-developed plan being executed. And I'm really excited to see how this helps our state's economy.
You know, well, I recall, I think, going on a tour many moons ago, and at the time, I think Gary North was with Hugs, and, you know, we were talking about the modernization plan way back when, and it's just taken a while to actually get the money together and see the work get underway over there at Kapalama.
Right. The plans to redevelop the harbors have been longstanding, and Gary retired before the completion of the Kapalama container terminal, but I keep in close contact with him, and he is definitely the dean of some of these projects. So I look forward to being able to share with him the good news when that is finally completed.
Well, it is impressive. I mean, Harbors took me out on a tour there. So to see it taking shape, and there's a fair amount of work that's been done, and we just have to get through this last home stretch in this last year.
Yes. As the plan for modernization has progressed, of course, the awareness and the needs about climate change and other worldwide effects that are making our container ship industry much more in the forefront of our minds and our policymakers' minds. We need to make sure that our plan addresses the needs of today. And I think DOT Harbors is doing such a good job at that.
Well, tell us more about this campaign that you're going to launch.
Yeah. So the Hawaii Harbors Users Group is starting a Supply Chain Hawaii Communications Initiative. Our website will have resources and information about how harbors fits into the bigger picture of the state's economy. And we've already been going out to many of the Hawaii Harbors Users Group member companies and filming, for example, what does it take to power a ship, or how does a car get from one island to the next? And we've been posting that on Instagram and Facebook and really getting a positive reaction, because I think it helps people understand how harbors are connected to the economy. And I think once we get a good amount of content and a body of information out there, we'll start to branch out and show the other parts of the supply chain, all the way back from manufacturing and where our goods come from to other transportation like airports and airlines on how things get here. But I'm really excited about it, and I hope that people will look to our website, which will be supplychainhawaii.com, and our social media, which is already starting to provide information out there.
I understand that we have a wheel and spoke system, and that we often hear a lot about the just-in-time economy, that, you know, we only have a few weeks of goods on our shelves, and so those have to be replenished periodically.
We have a hub and spoke system in Hawaii where our goods primarily come through Honolulu Harbor. And that's important to understand because as we experience storms or other disruptions, the focus is on really ensuring that Honolulu Harbor stays operational. In addition to working closely with DOT harbors, we work closely with partners like the U.S. Coast Guard. Recently during Hurricane Hone, we were watching very closely and ensuring that shipping wasn't disrupted by staying in really good communication with the National Weather Service and the Coast Guard.
I think we all learned a tough lesson during the pandemic, you know, about the supply chain issues that could come up. But if we could be assured that our harbors were all free and cleared and in the best state, that that's going to go a long way. So we don't have a run on toilet paper every time we get a storm.
I think the more people understand how supply chain works and the redundancies and efficiencies we have built into the system, the less we'll see sort of panic moments and we'll have a better understanding of what the capacity is. So, for example, I received questions during the recent East Coast harbor strikes, and that was not anticipated to and did not affect Hawaii shipping. And so I think just realizing the bulk of our goods come from the West Coast, and we have systems in place to make sure that we have adequate supplies. This is part of why we wanted to start a communications initiative.
I know it's a bit of a dance there at the docks, but we look around and we see a lot of automation in harbors across the world. I don't know how that fits into the modernization plan and where we've got those automation systems planned.
Yeah, of course, modernization encompasses many things, including the use of technology and automation at an appropriate level. Having our partners in labor and our workforce is also a key element of what we'll be talking about in the Supply Chain Hawaii Communications Initiative. We really value our relationship with our workforces in the harbors, and we're actually hoping to use the Supply Chain Hawaii Initiative to stimulate interest in younger people in jobs in maritime. So we want to ensure that we have good paying jobs right here in Hawaii. And we want to ensure that younger and more younger students down in high school and middle school realize that they can have opportunities to work in the maritime industry. So automation, yes, certainly in terms of how containers are moved around the shipyard. That is definitely something that is happening, but not at the expense of our workforce or ensuring that we have redundancy, safety, et cetera.
So lots of discussion to be had, but I'm sure, yeah, that industry is not immune to the dwindling workforce that we're seeing across the state.
What I hear most from Hawaii Harbors Users Group members is that there is a never-ending appetite for good workers, and it's largely born out of this demographic that we don't have enough young people to replace the older people who are retiring. So first and foremost, we want to make sure at young ages, people realize they can be accountants or CEOs or have business careers, not only on ship, but in the companies that are working on shipping. And there are many other sectors of the maritime industry. We work with the cruise industry, the shipyard repair sector, and there are just so many different interesting and amazing high-paying jobs right here in Hawaii related to maritime. I'm really excited about this.
We've been hearing from Melissa Pavlicek. She's the executive director of the Hawaii Harbor Users Group. She was talking about the modernization of our harbors and Supply Chain Hawaii. Look for the rollout of the media campaign at the end of the week.
Did you miss the latest edition of The Conversation or Fresh Air? Sometimes you just can't listen to your favorite show when it airs on HPR, but you can listen to it on demand with our free mobile app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android. It even integrates with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, so you can listen hands-free in your car. Get the HPR app in the App Store or on Google Play.
Follow the money.
Candidates from both parties have to spend a much more significant amount of their time talking to rich people. That shapes their worldviews and it affects their ability to connect with their constituents.
Billionaires and the surprisingly legal ways their big money is working in collaboration with presidential campaigns. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
I hear the words yellow tang and I think bling of the reef, the fish, also called lemon sailfin. They dance and they dart around the coral heads and like jewels adorn and sparkle across what is otherwise a pretty bland landscape, or seascape, I should say. Sean Moss is the executive director of Hawaii Pacific University's Oceanic Institute. He stopped by our studios to talk about the planned release of these fish on Oahu's windward side this weekend. Ornamental aquacultured fish could be an option for diversifying our economy. The aquarium trade is nothing to sneeze at. Here's Moss explaining why this weekend will mark a milestone in conservation and aquatic research.
We've been trying to aquaculture yellow tang, I would say, for over 20 years. In the early 2000s, we collected some wild tang broodstock, and we wanted to see if we can aquaculture them in captivity because it's an iconic fish in the global aquarium, saltwater aquarium trade. Yet most of the saltwater fish collected for this $100 million a year industry are collected from the wild. And there is, of course, debate as to whether that's a sustainable fisheries or not. So we wanted to provide an alternative to wild caught fish by aquaculturing this iconic Hawaii coral reef species, the yellow tang. So we went out and collected broodstock. It took several years to figure out how to get them to sexually mature in captivity, you know, the right music, the right amount of candlelight, and all of that. No, it's diet, water quality. And so after several years of research, we got them to be able to produce fertilized eggs in captivity. And so that was one milestone we overcame. And then the next challenge was taking these tiny, tiny fish larvae, which are the size of the pin of a needle. They're barely visible with the naked eye, and get them to settle to juveniles so that we could then sell them into the aquarium trade if that was the end use. That problem was far more challenging than getting them to mature in captivity. And it took us maybe 10 years to figure out what these baby yellow tang ate once they used up their yolk sac. So after the fertilized egg, they have a yolk sac like most fish eggs, and it takes about 3 days to use up the yolk. And after that yolk sac is utilized, they are what are called obligatory live prey feeders. They have to eat something live. And in nature, of course, they'll feed on minute zooplankton. The type of live prey we were using in aquaculture at that time were way too big for these tiny, tiny larvae to eat. It would be like us trying to eat an elephant. And so it took us literally about 10 years to identify a plankton, a zooplankton in the ocean that was sufficiently small to fit into the baby larval tang's mouth. And then once we identified what that species of zooplankton was, it's called a copepod. Once we were able to identify that, we then had to mass culture that for the baby larvae yellow tang. But that was the Coca-Cola formula. So once we were able to figure out what to feed these yellow tang after they used their yolk sac, we were able to start to get them to settle in captivity and turn out to be those beautiful canary yellow tang that we know so well. Once we developed that technology, we partnered with a commercial partner to try and get these aquacultured yellow tang into the marine ornamental trade pipeline. As an alternative to wild caught yellow tang. Now, up until I think pre-COVID, Hawaii was kind of the epicenter for the collection and sale of yellow tang into the global aquarium trade. Wild collectors were getting about 300 to 400,000 a year off the Kailua Kona coast on the Big Island.
Wow.
So we wanted to provide this alternative to wild caught yellow tang. Kind of concurrent with that effort to provide this alternative to the aquarium industry, we got funding from Georgia Aquarium. And if you've never been to the Georgia Aquarium, it's a beautiful aquarium. I would recommend going if you're ever in Georgia. It's an absolutely fantastic aquarium, and they too have a mission of sustainability. So they provided funding to Oceanic Institute. to form a partnership with Disney's Aulani Resort to go out to their reef aquarium display, where you can either look at the coral reef fish through a big glass, or you can actually go snorkeling in the reef tank. It's the Rainbow Reef Aquarium over there. And they have a population of local coral reef fish in there that think they're out in the wild. So they're spawning just like the fish do in the coral reefs. But the eggs that the fertilized eggs that were being produced were largely just discarded. They go through a chlorine contactor, the water's recirculated to keep it clean for visitors. And so all of these fish eggs were basically going down the drain. And a few years ago, Dr. Chad Callan, who was running our finfish department, he now works at UH Hilo, he worked with the folks at Aulani to put fish egg collectors in their display and bring those fertilized, instead of essentially flushing them, bring them back to Oceanic Institute, where our fish experts can raise those fertilized eggs to yellow tang juveniles. That's the gold mine. And what we did was we provided enough yellow tang juveniles where we sent some back to Georgia Aquarium. We sent some to Maui Ocean Center, Sea Life Park, Waikiki Aquarium. The goal of that project wasn't to get them into the marine ornamental fish commercial pipeline. It was to provide the public and private display of marine ornamental fish for education and advocacy of conservation, rather than collect them from the wild. All of these aquariums have a goal of starting to replace wild-caught shrimp with captive-reared. It's just simply more sustainable. And with this partnership between Georgia Aquarium, Aulani Resort, and OI, we were able to collect the fertilized eggs that was otherwise a waste stream and turn it into something of value. Once we provided the aquaria with all of the fish they needed, we did such a good job at the larval rearing, we had surplus. And so we thought, okay, what are we going to do with these excess yellow tang? Let's ask the state DLNR if we could release them into the environment. And they just recently approved it. And so now we're gearing up for a release of several hundred juvenile yellow tang back into our nearshore waters to replace and replenish these very important herbivorous fish. Yellow tang are herbivores. They graze the reef. They keep the reef healthy. They've been tremendously overfished in recent decades. So this is a real opportunity to provide another tool in the toolbox for marine conservation.
Well, you know, I used to get very excited when I'd see, you know, like seven yellow tang swimming out at Kaimana, you know, like, come on, guys, you know, let's grow your numbers. Yeah. Because, you know, snorkeling at Mahukona and just seeing, you know, just how much more populated that area was, you could really tell. So, you know, like, we're rooting for you guys.
Yeah, that's great.
So this is a nice shot in the arm.
Yes, no, we appreciate that support. This first release is probably going to be more symbolic than impactful. Our numbers are small, but again, it's showing people, showing the community, showing the state that, hey, look, we're developing this really novel approach to coral reef health. Coral reefs, they're valued at $33 billion and generate over $800 million a year annually, our coral reefs, but their health is in jeopardy because of the onslaught of stressors, global stressors like global climate change, and even local stressors like sunbathers wearing sunscreen. So these coral reefs are assaulted. And so anything we can do, any tools we can develop to help nurture these very important ecosystems along, I think is a worthy endeavor.
Are there any details that you can share with us about where and when, or is that still in the planning stage?
They're in the tail end of the planning stage later this week. So we'll probably be doing two releases in Waimanalo, one at Kaiona Beach Park near the Obama House, and that's where we're going to try and harmonize our release with some events that the Waimanalo Limuhui is sponsoring. This Saturday, November 2nd, they're going to do an outplanting of limu. We've worked with Ikaika Rogerson out there before, and they do a great job at getting limu, aquacultured limu, and outplanting it because, like the yellow tang, limu has very important ecosystem services. They help create a healthy environment. They outplant some of the limu, and we're going to try and dovetail our activities with Ikaika's activity. They're also celebrating their 7th year anniversary for the Waimanalo Limuhui. We want to celebrate with them about that. And then we may do another release near Kaupo, right across the street from the Makapu'u HPU's Makapu'u campus right next to Sea Life Park. We may do a targeted small release there as well. So we're really excited about doing that. I should point out that prior to the release, we're going to have a state biologist come out and inspect our fish. We want to make sure they're healthy and they're not carrying any pathogens. So we're going to get the sign-off from a DLNR biologist. If they show any signs of pathogen or disease, we'll terminate the release. But we're very confident they're alive and well and healthy and free of any pathogen. They look great in our biosecure fish hatchery, so we're not expecting any problem. But the DLNR biologist will just provide another level of inspection and scrutiny on the health of the fish, because we only want to release healthy fish.
This whole issue of the aquarium trade, I know it's been a contentious one. Yes. With the state, but how do we make sure that, you know, the fish that we're releasing aren't just scooped up by the aquarium trade?
Well, right now, the ability for collectors to go out and collect fish for the aquarium trade has been a contentious issue. And right now, as I understand, prior to COVID, I think there was a ban. The DLNR had not provided any licenses. They put a moratorium on the collection. The injunction was lifted fairly recently, but as far as I understand, the board, DLNR board, has not allowed any licenses yet. I think it's imminent, but I think they're going to be restricted licenses. So right now, legally, you can't go out and collect fish for the aquarium trade. When the licenses are administered, I think the state will be fairly restrictive. I don't think we'll ever go back to collecting 300,000, 400,000 off the Kailua Kona coast again. I think it's going to be a much more restricted activity.
Yeah, I mean, we do want to give these fish a chance, right?
Absolutely. So we're hoping with these targeted releases, we'll release them in areas where we think the habitat is suitable for them to be protected against predators. But we're, again, cautiously optimistic it will actually have an impact. We're more excited about the symbolic research milestone. And what we're hoping is we get this out into the general public and the state gets interested in funding the research to do a more robust kind of stock enhancement program, not only of fish for ecosystem service provision like the yellow tang, but food fish. We, OI, as you may recall, Oceanic Institute, was involved in the stock enhancement of both striped mullet, the ama-ama, back in the 1990 to 2000. We released over 268,000 baby mullet off the coast of the Big Island, and it had a material impact on the recreational fisheries there. And then over a seven-year period, we released about 500,000 baby moi into nearshore waters in Kahana Bay, for example. And that, too, had a material impact on recreational fisheries. But that was for food. This is the release of the yellow tang. This is what makes this an historic event. This is really the first that I'm aware of, the first known stock enhancement release of fish, not to eat as a food, but to help protect the reef. And that's why I was anxious to talk to you about it, because I think this might be the first time, certainly in Hawaii, where aquacultured fish have been released into the environment, not to go eat for human consumption. We've done that, and we need to do that more. But this is for ecosystem services, for taking care of the reef. And that's why this is such a watershed moment for us.
That was Sean Moss, Executive Director of HPU's Oceanic Institute. He was talking about the planned release of Hawaiian yellow tang on Oahu's windward shores later this week.
HPR Generation Listen invites you to Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. It's an opportunity to connect with fellow public radio nerds in an evening of lively but friendly competition. Gen Listen connects younger listeners and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Connect with us in person at HPR Gen Listen Trivia. Sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
On the next Fresh Air, Alex Van Halen talks about being the drummer and co-founder of the iconic rock band Van Halen, and about his younger brother Eddie, who is the band's guitarist and main songwriter, and was considered one of rock's greatest guitarists. Eddie died of cancer in 2020. Alex has written a new memoir called Brothers. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
HPR reporter Ashley Mizzouo has been taking a look at the ballot questions across the state. She joins us this morning as we head into the home stretch of the general election. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's on tap for us this day?
Right. There's two constitutional amendments on the ballot. So we're going to talk about them in order. The first one is, shall the state constitution be amended to repeal the legislature's authority to reserve marriage to opposite sex couples? And so I've been seeing people posting about the wording on this being confusing. So to be clear, it's not asking you to legalize same-sex marriage. Hawaii already did that in 2013, and it's definitely not asking to take away the right to same-sex marriage. It's asking to remove a portion of the Constitution, which is Section 23, that says the legislature shall have the power to reserve marriage to opposite-sex couples. I spoke with Jeff Hong, chair of Change 23 Coalition, which has been fighting to remove Section 23. He says it's important to remove what he calls legal landmines, and that's becoming more important to solidify protections for same-sex couples as LGBTQ rights have become increasingly threatened at a federal level.
The Supreme Court has ruled that same-sex marriage is covered under equal protection under the law. But that was a 5-4 decision. And if it came up to the Supreme Court today, that probably would not have happened, right? The nature has changed. But assuming that that went away, a future legislature would not have to do anything but to pass a law, and then same-sex marriage would go away in Hawaii.
Yeah, and I've heard some folks say, well, we should, you know, keep this in the Constitution because you want to give the law, future lawmakers, that option. But yeah, some folks say no.
Right, because he's, you know, Hong is referencing the U.S. Supreme Court, which has indicated that it could be open to relitigating the protection of same-sex marriage at a federal level, even though they ruled in favor of it in 2015. So really what proponents of this constitutional amendment want is they just want that language in there removed, even though it's not really been used in any way, especially since, Hawaii did pass same-sex marriage back in 2013. Hawaii inserted Section 23 into its constitution in 1998 after getting 69% of voter approval, and it was largely viewed as backlash after the Hawaii Supreme Court became the first in the world to rule in favor of same-sex marriage in 1993. And so basically what they're saying is this should be removed, it shouldn't be part of our constitution, and that if we leave it in there in the future, if the federal protections for same-sex marriage are struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, there really wouldn't be any thing stopping lawmakers from walking back on the 2013 law that, you know, gives the right to same-sex marriage here in Hawaii. So proponents are saying vote yes on this amendment to remove it if you're in favor of same-sex marriage in Hawaii.
And the language is pretty wordy, and so people look at this and they don't really understand it and they just leave it blank, and that counts as a no vote, correct?
Correct, because you have to get the majority of votes cast. So that's totally correct, that if you are unsure, you should do some research, because leaving it blank is essentially a no vote. The second question, which is another constitutional amendment, it's a really long one, so I'm not going to read it, but it's asking if the Constitution should be amended to make the appointment process for district court judges more similar to the process of other judges. And this is kind of a wonky one, so we're going to please stay with me, because it's actually quite important when it comes to the Senate's ability to appoint judges in a kind of timely and more streamlined manner. So currently there are two different processes to appoint and confirm judges. There's one for district court judges and another for Supreme Court, Intermediate Court of Appeals, and Circuit Court judges, so all the other judges. The Chief Justice appoints district court judges and the governor appoints the others. This question does not impact that. A yes vote would change how the Chief Justice gets the final pool of candidates and how the Senate confirms district court judges to the same process as the other courts. So here's how they currently work. The Judicial Selection Commission, which is a 9-member body appointed by the state bar and legislative leadership appointed body, they are required to give the Chief Justice 6 or more names for district court vacancies. But for all the other courts, it's required to give the governor between 4 and 6 names. So voting yes would make the number of required candidates for district court the same as the others, between 4 and 6.
So it's standardizing it.
Exactly. And then the other change is when the Senate confirms these judges. So the Senate has 30 days to confirm judicial nominees. And if the candidate is rejected, the Chief Justice or the governor has 10 days to pick someone else from the list, and the cycle goes on until someone is approved. And if that fails, the Judicial Selection Commission makes the final decision. And the difference here is in the process is if the Senate misses the deadline. For district court judges, that decision goes back to the Judicial Selection Commission to make the final decision. And for others, if the Senate misses the deadline, the nominee is automatically confirmed. So voting yes would make district court judges the same as the others. And this is important because, you know, it's an initiative from the Senate that confirms many judicial appointments, and they just want it to be more streamlined between the two processes.
And often we often hear of the senators going back into session.
Exactly.
Just to confirm.
So this would, in theory, decrease that.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
That was HPR's Ashley Mazua with our election wrap for today. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. A young woman from Kauai is competing on the current season of The Voice, the NBC singing competition. Her name is Ana Isabel Fernandez, but she goes by the stage name of Bea. She was born in Lihue and grew up between the Garden Isle and Northern California. Earlier this month, she was picked to be part of Coach Gwen Stefani's team. The Conversation's Russell Subiona recently got the chance to talk to the 24-year-old Bea.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your life growing up?
Yeah, like what we were doing, just the hours I'd spend trying to open coconuts and catch all the tadpoles over in the Anahola River mouth there.
Right.
Yeah, so my great-grandma and my great-granddaddy, they were in a little shack in Anahola, and that's where most of my family was. We'd conglomerate there, you know, all pile in. Grandma had some beds at the bottom, so. And yeah, grandma, when she taught me how I could eat one flower, I'd go around and try to eat all the flowers in her garden. So sweet memories over there. And then eventually we kind of dispersed over kind of in Kapahi area and towards the North Shore. And I'm really grateful to have my family here still. All these people who have just been so behind me on this journey. Even when I was singing at like 8 years old, my auntie was like telling my mom that she needs to put me in music lessons or something because she saw the spark, and they all just gave me the kindling to do what I'm doing today.
So you did start singing at a young age. Did you go through any formal education? Did you get into singing lessons or anything like that?
Yeah. When I was really young, I was like kind of just, you know, in my own fairy tale. Of course, there's so much inspiration around us here. You know, I was just like singing to the birds and talking to the animals. But I think around like 10 years old, my mom got me into piano lessons, you know. And with that, my music teacher, Kenny Steele, legend, like rocker, wears denim, still has like the gray fluffy hair. He also did music lessons and like voice lessons. Most importantly, he started to do showcases with the students, which made you get up on a stage and perform in front of an audience of people, which are like the parents. But my first performance, I cried, you know? I came off the stage in tears because it was terrifying. So we've come a long way.
You like a lot of different genres. You have a lot of experience with different genres. What are some of your musical influences?
My first musical influence since I was a kid, you know, and I memorized most of his songs, is Jack Johnson. It's always better when we're together. Yeah, we'll look at them stars when we're together. I think for me, I really resonate with his message and the way that he delivers a song and a story and just like can make me feel things. I love his music and the way that he's done his career so sustainably, that's inspiring, and I strive to do something like that, you know, balancing family, balancing people of the Aina, you know, bringing music around and like inspiring those people to help and to just love. I think that's just one of my staples for sure. I've had such a variety of music in my ears as a kid. You know, growing up, it was Talking Heads, and my favorite song was like Psycho Killer to sing on karaoke. Through high school, I got into my Rolling Stones phase, and then through college, I got into like my more alternative music phase and Amy Winehouse too, and Etta James, and these kind of legends that have lived on past their time. It's just been a good influence.
The song that you sang for your blind audition was Ruby and the Romantics, Our Day Will Come, which is a song from the 1960s, well before your time or even my time.
No one can tell me that I'm too young to know. I love you so, and you love me. Oh yeah, oh, our day will come.
Come on, Michael, it's right up your alley.
If we just wait.
How did you come to know that song, and why did you decide to sing that song for the audition?
So I was given another song as my audition song, which was Toxic by Britney Spears. And it was scary, but I wrote back and I said, that doesn't really resonate with me or my message as a musician, or like, if this is my one song to America, I kind of want it to mean a little bit something different. And they actually gave me another chance to find a song that resonates with me. So they sent me a collection of them, and one of them was Our Day Will Come. And it was the Amy Winehouse version. And Amy Winehouse and I have, I think, felt similar ranges and tones. And so I was inclined to pick that. Plus, I was just singing it into existence.
I really like that you added an island vibe to your rendition. Was that something that you asked for specifically?
Yeah, for sure. I love reggae, and there's definitely something you can do there. They give you this kind of flexibility to make it your own. And the song is kind of hard to make completely different. I tried, but this is kind of just a little flavor with also honoring the original tune.
I know that The Voice likes to challenge contestants to grow and push their boundaries as an artist by switching up genres and asking artists to sing songs that they may have never heard before. What in your background or skill set prepares you to be able to take on that challenge?
I believe that if you find a song that gets your body moving, I think there's a way that you can start making it your own. And with all of these varieties of songs that I've sung in the past, I've had a lot of fun just like turning a ballad into something more upbeat and reggae. Like my friend Javi and I, we just recently did I'd Rather Go Blind. Make it reggae, you know, or just like take these genres and do a little twist. And so even if it's maybe the tempo is not right for you, I think there's a way to make it your own. And that's the fun part for me.
I know that The Voice is good television, and I know that it's very interesting to follow all the contestants as they move forward in their music journey. But I know it also takes a lot of guts to kind of put yourself out there on national TV. Why is this opportunity important to you?
I think my dream, I know my dream, I feel my dream to be ultimately to bring together a band and to go around and share music. And if we can bring around a posse of people, maybe 10, maybe 100, maybe 10,000, that would be just a cherry on top. But ultimately just sharing the music. And also I think where I come from, the family that I was raised by, the people I'm surrounded by, there's such a message behind Baya and what good can be in the world, and also just to like be able to present myself authentically to Hollywood and to them see me for that and also help that message come through is even more beautiful. So I think using this platform for change for the better is going to be very powerful, and I'm excited to see where we take it.
Baya, thanks so much for your time this morning. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. Mahalo.
Look what you've done, made me woman, in love with my song.
That was 24-year-old Kauai singer Baya talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Baya will be part of the battle rounds of the NBC show The Voice tonight. We'll have a link to more information on our website later today.
Brighter than the sun. What you've done left me the question.
Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to hear from a state archivist about protecting our treasures, which are stored in basements, which are vulnerable to floodwaters. Have a memory to share about the Manoa floods of 2004? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for The Conversation.